back in 2014, I worked at a passport factory. And was I a State Department employee? No. There was a main contractor, and I worked for the subcontractor at very low wages. It was a virtual sweatshop. Then recently, I discovered that to visit or telephone anyone at the Pima County Jail here in Tucson, one must go through a private company. I found this very annoying, and it got me to thinking about all this contracting from city parks and recs departments to private prisons to, of course, the military. And the Raytheon Missile Company here in Tucson, I believe, is locally the number one private employer. I'm looking forward to the show. Thanks.
Today, we're taking a look at the world of government contracting as part of our Listener Pick series. This idea came to us from Leo in Tucson, Arizona, who we just heard. After the break, we'll dig deep into private military contractors. You'll hear what we learned from relying on for-profit defense businesses during the Afghanistan war and how much money continues to go to contracting. I'm Jen White. This is the 1A podcast where we get to the heart of the story. Remember, to join future conversations, download our 1A Vox Pop app and leave us a voicemail. We'll get into that and more after the break.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Yogi Tea. We know that sometimes finding a moment for yourself isn't so simple, but self-care doesn't have to be complicated. In fact, it can be as simple as brewing yourself a warm, comforting cup of Yogi Honey Lavender Stress Relief Tea. With soothing aromatics like lavender, chamomile, and lemon balm, this relaxing herbal tea blend encourages you to take a moment to pause, step away from the chaos of the day, and sip your way to a more stress-free state of mind. Support your well-being with Yogi Tea.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
We're discussing America's use of private military contractors in Afghanistan and the lessons we've learned. Joining us to talk about it, Sean McFate, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. He's also author of New Rules of War, Victory in the Age of Durable Disorder. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Wonderful to be here.
Also with us is Jessica Donati. She's a foreign affairs reporter at The Wall Street Journal and author of Eagle Down, The Last Special Forces Fighting the Forever War. Jessica, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And William Hartung, a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's also author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. William, thanks for joining us.
Oh, yes. Thanks for having me, and thanks for putting together this great panel.
And we reached out to five of the biggest defense contracting companies, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Dynamics, and Northrop Grumman, all turned down the offer to come on the show or to give a statement. Well, William, let's just start with the basics. What do we mean when we say private military contractor?
Well, there's a wide range. There's companies that provide services in war zones, like building bases, feeding the troops, training foreign military forces. There's the weapon suppliers, like the top five that you mentioned. Some people think of it in terms of just the private company people who carry guns in war zones, but it's much broader than that if you really look at it.
Sean, give us some context here. What's the history of defense contracting in the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. has always used contractors. It's not unusual, but what's different in the last 20 years is the scale and scope of it. So, for example, in World War II, about 10% of our force was contracted, and they did, you know, largely logistics. But over the Iraq and Afghanistan war, it went from 10% to 50% in Iraq and 75% in Afghanistan. So that means, you know, for every, for example, in Iraq, for every one soldier, there was a contractor. And most of these contractors were not US citizens fighting our wars for us. And what was especially different is that we hired trigger pullers. Some would say mercenaries, like Blackwater. And many American soldiers say, no, this is not how the United States should fight.
Well, in theory, Sean, what's the reason the government uses contractors, and especially this ramp up over the last 20 years?
Well, in theory, is that contractors can provide necessary, say, support functions more cheaply and more innovatively by competing out contracts. It's how capitalism works at its best. And this really started during the Reagan era, when the idea to start to contract out government services more. But they never envisioned it in, you know, contracting out what many consider to be inherently governmental jobs, like, you know, security, as well as just the general, as William was saying, how much of this was being contracted. And the reason we got to this point is, like many things in those wars, it didn't happen on purpose. It happened just because. If you recall, in 2002, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld assured the U.S. government, assured everybody that these would be short, quick wars. He told people that, you know, the war in Iraq would last days or weeks at most, certainly not months. That was 2002. And when they discovered that these were not going to be short wars, we also discovered that our all-volunteer military didn't have enough volunteers to do all the jobs. So they had, policymakers had some bad options. One is to leave Iraq and Afghanistan and admit defeat to ISIS or, you know, Al-Qaeda or whomever. The second was to have a Vietnam-like draft to fill all the military billets, which all of which would have been political suicide. And the third option was to contract out the difference. And that's how it began. Just, we're going to contract out the difference. And over the years, it went from just a trickle to 75% of our military footprint now are contractors. Mm-hmm.
Jessica, specifically in Afghanistan, what was the range of tasks these contractors provided or services they provided?
I mean, contractors were used to do absolutely everything from providing the logistical support to bases, bringing food and water, clearing waste, just basics on the ground. But you also had contractors providing security to embassies. You had contractors running much of the surveillance operations, operating drones from afar, helping with the air support. I mean, the number of contractors went up and up and up as the Afghan war became increasingly unpopular, because contractors were a really good way to keep the number of troops down. So you could say, as they did for much of 2015 onwards, oh, we have fewer than 10,000 troops in Afghanistan. Well, the reality that the number of people on the ground had rocketed up by using contractors to fill in roles.
Well, you reached out to the Pentagon to respond to the growing use and money given to private contractors. DOD spokesperson Jessica Maxwell sent over this statement that reads in part, quote, "While contracting for contingencies is not new, DOD's use of contractors increased significantly over the last decade. The nature, duration, and complexity of DOD operations, coupled with force structure changes and limitations, as well as advances in technology and weaponry, have contributed to this increase. Contracted personnel provide an adaptable mix of unique skill sets, local insight, and staying power that a strictly military force cannot cultivate or resource for all scenarios. Contracts can provide supplies and services while alleviating stress on our military capabilities, reducing military footprint, and increasing military availability. The DOD carefully determines where and when to use contracted support. In making that determination, the DOD considers the efficiency with which support can be provided by contract personnel versus DOD personnel, the need for DOD personnel to perform inherently governmental functions, and other total force mix related considerations." And you can read the full statement on our website, the1a.org. William, what role does the DOD play in overseeing and managing contractors?
Well, it's interesting. That Pentagon statement sounds great, but it doesn't really match reality, unfortunately. I mean, they're supposed to be coordinating the contractors, having people on the ground to see what they're actually doing, tracking the money. and so forth. But if you look at it carefully, they don't even have one central place to collect that data, much less track it. And according to the Commission on Wartime Contracting, which 10 years into the war found up to $60 billion in waste, one out of every $4 spent on reconstruction and troop support, that hasn't changed. The Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction has done dozens and dozens of reports of projects not finished. They've convicted for fraud over 160 individuals and companies. They've saved about $3.8 billion out of the hundreds and hundreds of billions that have gone out the door to contractors. So I think DOD, they certainly know it's a problem. They even cited that waste figure in one of their kind of documents promising to do better. But I don't think we've really seen a lot of improvement. I think part of it has to do with just the chaos of war. If you're going to fight these big wars like in Iraq and Afghanistan, you're going to pour billions and billions of dollars day in, day out, month in, month out. It's going to be very hard to avoid waste. I mean, if you want to avoid waste, the best way to do it is not fight unnecessary large-scale wars like we did in Iraq and Afghanistan.
William, walk us through a bit of the contracting process. How do companies bid the government for these projects?
Well, it's interesting. Even at this late date, there's a lot of no-bid contracts or just a couple contractors. In the context of the wars, they created a contract called LOGCAP, which is Logistics Civil Augmentation Program, for those who like jargon. And that was basically initially given to Halliburton, which was Dick Cheney's company, while he was vice president. So there was a revolving door conflict of interest element there. But once they got the contract, it was open-ended. It was almost like a charge card. They could just keep charging over and over and over for new activities with very little oversight. Sort of like having an expense account that nobody's tracking. And then the big companies, the Lockheed Martins and so forth, the big five pulled down $2 trillion since 2001. Many of those were cost-plus contracts or contracts where they would even get reimbursed for shoddy work, they'd get paid to fix their own mistakes. So there is some competition. There are some good contract auditors. There's an Inspector General's office. There's an office that tries to do independent assessments of testing and so forth. But it's hard to keep, right herd on a industry that gets $420 billion in Pentagon money every year and probably 500,000 contract personnel. They can't even keep count. In fact, Robert Gates, when he was defense secretary, said, I can't tell you how many contractors we employ. And I think that's still the case. So the Pentagon has some procedures, but they're often violated in practice, even though in theory there's supposed to be competition and close oversight.
Now, Jessica, you recently wrote about contractors, and I'll use your framing here, winning big in the Afghanistan war. What did you find in your reporting?
I mean, in the reporting, it was the challenge we had was to identify which projects would be the best ones to show the scale of waste that happened in Afghanistan, because billions and billions were poured in and were wasted. And I think one of the projects that I wanted to talk about was the flagship women's project. And this shows how contracting really sort of goes wrong there. Towards the end of the war, the U.S. announced, we're going to do something for Afghan women. And they announced a $400 million program, which instantly made everybody worried because they did not have the means to spend that money responsibly because they were barely allowed outside of the embassy. But then when you dug deeper into the numbers, you saw that it was actually only $200 million because the other half was relying on contributions from other countries that never came. And when it came to what they concretely achieved, they just farmed it out to the same big names that William was listing earlier, and they spent much of that money on overhead, security, and that sort of thing. And by the time that you actually looked at how much went to ordinary Afghan women, you found that was a tiny fraction, and that was increasingly the story of contracting in Afghanistan as security got worse, as the embassy was increasingly locked down and unable to go out and monitor its projects and understand the environment and what was needed there.
Well, let's listen to a voicemail we got from Lyle in South Carolina.
I'm a former Army officer and Green Beret, and I've worked in Iraq and Afghanistan. as a contractor. The U.S. military cannot go to war without contractors. The issue becomes when there is a lack of proper oversight and accountability. That results in fraud, waste, and abuse.
Jessica, what did that oversight piece look like in Afghanistan?
I mean, the amount of money that was spent there was just impossible to oversee. And so you had the special inspector general that was charged with trying to look over it, but they had a limited team. They had limited time. And over the years, they also had very little access. They relied on the embassy to provide them with the security escorts that they needed to go out and check on projects. And obviously, the embassy had an incentive not to give them great access to the country. And at any rate, the last sort of 5-10 years of the war, it wasn't really possible to travel around. So oversight really was limited in that sense. But I mean, a listener who left his voicemail, I mean, it's absolutely right. I remember going to visit a team of Green Berets out, you know, 12 guys in the middle of nowhere in a very volatile, dangerous part of the country. And there were about 12 Green Berets and 120 contractors there. They were providing, securing the camp, for one. So they were basically hired guns. And there were also contractors providing the food and the water and bringing them the mail and all these things. So, I mean, they were totally dependent on the private sector.
Sean, in your research, how often do you find examples of waste, fraud, or abuse in military contracting?
It's part of war, and I think some of the special inspector generals have done a pretty jaw-dropping job of exposing some of this. One infamous example is during the war in Afghanistan, somebody had the bright idea in the government that, well, to replace heroin, we can have a cashmere trade in Afghanistan, so we're going to buy like 9 Italian goats, like Gucci goats, for $6 million to get them there. I mean, this is, again, bad policymaking that contractors have to figure out how to make happen. So I think your caller is correct. There were a lot of good people on the ground just trying to do the best they could. Not everybody in the industry was a crook, but if you look at the numbers, as William has done, it's certainly, you know, there's some problems there.
We'll continue our discussion of the Pentagon's use of private contractors in just a moment. A reminder to have your questions answered on future topics or just to let us know what you think, tweet us at 1A.
Support for NPR and the following message come from BetterHelp, offering online counseling. BetterHelp therapist Hesu Jo knows that lockdown has been hard on us as humans.
We as people are hardwired to connect with others, which is why this whole time is so difficult. The connection that happens between people can be very powerful, and how healing it can be to have a healthy relationship with someone.
To get matched with a counselor within 48 hours and save 10%, go to betterhelp.com/1A.
Over this last year and a half, the world's been through a lot. So on this season of the StoryCorps podcast, we'll hear stories reminding us that even when times are hard, we can still begin again. Listen to our new season wherever you get your podcasts.
Now let's get back to our conversation about America's use of private security contractors. Jonathan emails, defense contractors are basically an employment program after retirement from the military after as little as 20 years of service. In my experience, they recreate the military hierarchies with the general leading the team and his or her former officers as subordinates. William, how often do military leaders move to the private sector?
Oh, it's very frequent. The GAO did a recent report that found there were 1,700 generals, admirals, former acquisition officials who had gone from government to the contractors. And the Project on Government Oversight maintains an extensive database on this. But it's also, I think we need to think about the fact that the revolving door spins both ways. People go from industry into high positions in government. 4 of our last 5 secretaries of defense came from the industry, either on the boards or as executives or as lobbyists for companies like Raytheon, General Dynamics, and Lockheed Martin. And that's common throughout the government. So if you're in government and you want to go work for industry, you may well go light on those companies that you want to work for. And if you're in government coming from industry, you may look a little more favorably on your former employers. So it's kind of a form of legalized corruption.
We got this email from Alex, who says, as a military advisor and officer, I frequently oversaw contractors and had a strong incentive to find any successes or reframe the efforts of our contractors because of the officer promotion system. I believe the military's officer promotion system and the tension of highlighting successes from contractors caused an overstatement of progress in Afghanistan and Iraq. We also got this tweet. Anybody who has read much history knows that mercenaries or contractors are not the best or even reliable soldiers. Neither are the reluctant. Good soldiers have to have personal investment. Pay isn't enough. William, how does this all bump up against politics?
Well, I think we have to follow the money, of course. I did a report for the Center for International Policy and the Cost of War Project at Brown, finding that, as you suggested, there was $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon in the last 20 years. $7 trillion of that went to contractors. So they have a huge incentive to keep the money flowing. And according to the Center for Responsive Politics, the arms industry spent about $2.5 billion on lobbying in the last 20 years to generate that $7 trillion. The top five alone spent $1 billion and got $2 trillion in return. So as one of my colleagues at the Quincy Institute pointed out, that means for every $1 in lobbying, they got over $1,800 in contracts. Now, it's not a one-to-one relationship. Obviously, they would have gotten some of those contracts anyway. But between the revolving door, campaign contributions, placing facilities in districts of key members of Congress who then don't want to vote against these things, you've got commissions that are, the personnel come from the industry that kind of shape what our government policy is going to be, including pushing, I think, an exaggerated sense of the threat from China. So all these politics come together so that this year, actually, the Pentagon got $25 billion more than it requested because members of Congress, many of whom had connections to the industry in their states or districts, pushed for that extra money.
Sean, go ahead, because, again, I think when we talk about the use of a military draft, that is going to bump up against politics.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think any politician or the Pentagon wants to see that. I mean, politicians who suggest that will probably get unelected. And the Pentagon thinks of the, when it thinks of the draft, it thinks of the drug-induced times of the early Vietnam War. They don't want that. They like the all-volunteer military that we have. There's a couple of exceptions, like retired General Stanley McChrystal, who would like to see this. But what it does is it creates public, like moral hazard in public policy making, because without the American people being engaged in what are foreign wars, what are we doing over there and why, it's very easy for these wars to continue sort of, under the radar. And this, what this really does is it lowers the barriers of going and sustaining wars. So that's what contractors, that's really the policy implications of contractors. It's not just the fraud, waste, and abuse. It allows the country to go and stay in wars that it ought not to stay in because it disguises and camouflages, again, the blood and the treasure that's really being invested in these places.
William, as of now, how much of the current Pentagon budget is going to contractors?
Well, as Congressional Research Service says, as of 2020, it was $420 billion, which was more than half the Pentagon budget. And the top five alone in every year get well over $100 billion of that. Lockheed Martin got $75 billion in the most recent year, which is 1.5 times the budget of the State Department and AID. So it's just a sense of our skewed priorities and our militarized budget. If we're going to put diplomacy first, we have to right that balance.
Sean, are there ripple effects you see from America's broad use of contractors that maybe wouldn't be apparent to most of us?
Oh, yes. So one of the things that using armed contractors, which let's be honest, I mean, of the contractors we used, only about 15 or 10% were armed, were trigger pullers. But those were not mostly American. And after the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, they have gone out into the world as mercenaries. We're seeing private military contractors or mercenaries in Yemen, in Syria, in Libya, in Venezuela, in Africa, you name it. And a lot of those guys, and the mostly guys, got their start in Afghanistan or Iraq. And also, Russia is using mercenaries, a thing called the Wagner Group, which they call a private military company. They're using mercenaries to do expeditionary operations in the Middle East and in Africa today, the first time since the Cold War. And their leading edge of their spear are mercenaries. Now, the U.S. cannot wag its finger at Russia saying, don't do this after we use so many contractors. Our use of contractors has sort of, you know, made... They've de facto legitimized the use of contractors and armed contractors. And this is one of the legacies of the war. It was never intended this way, but this is one of the implications that we're seeing pan out in the years ahead of us.
Well, and we did get this tweet from someone who asks, now that contractors in Afghanistan are out of work, where do they go? And Sean, you were speaking specifically to that, I think you said 10% of so-called trigger pullers. But what about the unarmed contractors? What happens to them?
That's a great question. And we don't really know, because a lot of those contractors are, you have prime contractors who have like the government contract, and they hire subcontractors whom we never really vetted very well and don't even know who many of them are. And they come, they're not all American. In fact, mostly they're not American. Some might seek, you know, if their contract was to repair Toyota trucks, you know, they might work for a garage, perfectly normal. So I think we're going to see a lot of that. There is an industry now of conflict logistical support out there that has been enhanced by the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, but they're just as likely now to work for the United Nations or for an NGO. You know, they'll go where the money is. I don't think that's so much a problem as the trigger pullers, because then you're linking profit motive with killing in global politics, and that's a cause for concern.
Jessica, briefly, is there a role contractors play in Afghanistan or Iraq today?
I mean, I think at the moment there's very little activity going on. But moving forward, the U.S. has announced plans to increase the delivery of aid, and the delivering aid requires security. So there will definitely be a demand for contractors as they start to ramp back up, at least in terms of development and aid.
William and Sean, I'd love to hear from you in this final minute. What you think the U.S. should consider in terms of its own policies and planning when it thinks about its use of defense contractors. William, I'll come to you first.
Well, we need a more restrained foreign policy. We need to end the forever wars, at which point you can have a smaller military that's less dependent on contractors. So I think that's kind of the headline of what we need to do. Then, of course, when they are used, there's got to be a lot more scrutiny along the lines of what the Special Inspector General for Afghan Reconstruction did. And we might even need that perhaps on a global scale as the U.S. is active in 85 countries.
Sean, your thoughts?
I would agree with that, but I would add this, is that the military has refused to learn how to deal with contractors on the ground. So if we're going to keep on using them, I see no reason why we won't. We need to include that in military officer and NCO training. And we need to also get a sort of a new specialty in the Pentagon on the ground of contract management. We don't fight wars like World War I and World War II anymore the same way. So we need to get savvy about how to handle contractors so they don't handle us.
That's Sean McFaid, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council and professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. He's also author of New Rules of War, Victory in the Age of Durable Disorder. Jessica Donati is also with us, foreign affairs reporter at the Wall Street Journal and author of Eagle Down. And William Hartung, a senior research fellow at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Thanks to you all. Today's producer was Michelle Harvin. Our podcast is produced by Barb Anguiano. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.